In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. Throughout history, have societies always been dominated by men? And how has patriarchal dominance shaped lives and societies across the centuries and the continents? Those are some of the questions at the heart of journalist and broadcaster Angela Saini's new book, The Patriarchs, How Men Came to Rule. Angela spoke to June Purvis, former Professor of Women's and Gender History at the University of Portsmouth and former Chair of the Women's History Network UK, to discuss the key themes of her book.
Well, thank you very much, Angela, for this impressive book. I read it with great interest because this concept of patriarchy, whereby men exercise control and power over women, is one I'm very interested in my own historical work and in the suffragette movement, simply because women had such a struggle against the all-male parliament in Britain to get the vote. So in your book, you range over the disciplines. I think that's what's really impressive about it. You go through science, archaeology, you look at studies of culture, political studies, etc., to try and explain why it is that patriarchy has been so evasive. So I think the first question I would ask is, how did patriarchy originate?
I wish there was that's a hard one. I wish there was one simple way to answer that question, but that was exactly the question that set this book in motion. In one of my previous books, Inferior, which looks at bias and discrimination within the sciences that led to a very skewed understanding of what women were and, you know, how we think, there was a chapter on male domination. And we know from anthropological evidence, it's quite widely accepted now, that humans haven't always been male dominated in the same way that we are now, that, you know, these ideas and these ideologies vary culturally and through time. And the question I was constantly asked by readers was, if we haven't always been this way, then how did we get here? How did patriarchy become so widespread? And I didn't really have a good answer, because there's so little literature on this. It was a big question in the 19th century. So people like Friedrich Engels, who with Karl Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto, they explored it. And one of his explanations was that all societies had been matriarchal once, and that there'd been this huge kind of historical defeat, in his words, of women, and that culminated in patriarchy. There are some people who think it's just natural that we have always been this way, that, you know, there's biological differences between men and women that just mean men have always held power. I think that's quite, even now in the 21st century, I think that's quite a widespread idea. And then there are many scholars who argue that it started with agriculture, that when we started keeping property, and then agriculture became a turning point, and because of the labor involved in agriculture, that women became more domesticated. And actually, what I've learned while I was writing this book is that none of those are completely true, obviously, and certainly not the biological explanation. But there are lots of different factors that feed into why a society moves towards men having more authority and women being more oppressed. And it varies depending on where you are in the world. So certainly in Europe, I would say that patriarchal beliefs and ideologies and systems are thousands of years old, but then there are other parts of the world in which they're very new, in which it's within living memory that these ideas were imported and started to change how people lived. And what precipitates that shift can be lots of different things. It can be cultural. It can be the product of colonialism, especially more recently. It can be religious. It can be a change in how people structure family. So whether you are patrilocal, which means do women go and live with their husbands or do husbands go and live with their wives? So all of these things become factors, and it really depends on where you are.
Yes, I mean, I was thinking of Gerda Lerner's book, came out 1963, I think, didn't it? The Creation of Patriarchy, where she argues that it is biological differences, that because women have to have the babies and they look after them, you know, that creates this sort of gender division and oppression within families. And I think I agree with you, it's an element of it, but there are also cultural differences building on from that. You mention in your book about the importance of the early states, that when families, etc., then grew into states, when you got a lot of them, and there was a big population, that you had to have organisation, etc., and that's where you think a lot of the patriarchal customs came in. Do you want to expand on that a little?
Yeah, I think, so if we look at this history, let's, for example, take this hypothesis that agriculture was a big turning point for women's oppression. The timeline doesn't fit that very well. We know that agriculture was practiced, or different forms of agriculture and domestication were practiced for a very long time before we see very rigidly gendered societies. And women were a big part of those agricultural projects. You know, women were involved in domestication and animal rearing, animal husbandry, and even ploughing. And, you know, very often I read in texts that, you know, because ploughing is work that requires upper body strength, that women would have been precluded from doing that. But actually, that's not borne out by the evidence that we see, because all over the world, women even do very hard manual labor. And I've seen that for myself in travels in Asia and Africa, that that's still true. So if agriculture isn't the turning point, then what was? And where we can definitely, in the literature and within the historical evidence, see things changing, it is at the development of those early states. So you mentioned Gerda Lerner, and certainly in the Creation of Patriarchy, this is what she investigated, was in ancient Mesopotamia and in Assyria, how laws very gradually changed over time, disenfranchising women, taking away their rights, sometimes in contradiction to what families actually wanted. So it wasn't that people were happy about this necessarily, but the state was imposing these rules on people in order to maintain the power structures that were so necessary to keep them intact. So James Scott, the anthropologist, said to me, what is the big preoccupation of those early states? It's population. It has to be. How do we get people to stay and serve, you know, these power structures when they could quite easily leave, which feels like a foreign concept to us now, because the idea of belonging to a state and being a citizen is so deep rooted in who we are. But that wouldn't have been true before antiquity and in prehistory. So this population question, I think, is really when you began to see gender as an organizing principle, when people were defined by very simple things, regardless of whether they actually wanted to do those things or not. So women, young women, began to be categorized according to their ability to have children or not, whether or not they could have children or not. Young men were expected to fight and defend their state, whether or not they wanted to do it. So that's where you see the erasure of that individuality and gender become a much more rigid binary thing.
Yes, I think that's a really interesting analysis, which I was intrigued about. You also mention in your book about how pervasive patriarchy is. It's economic, so that could be differences in pay. It can be physical. You know, women can be confined to the home or have to wear a veil, as in Afghanistan now. Exploring a bit more about how patriarchy works, I was interested in your examples looking at the Russian Revolution and the revolution in Iran in 1979. Let's just go to the Russian Revolution, first of all. How did patriarchy work there, do you think?
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
So Russia, before the Bolshevik Revolution, was a very patriarchal place, extremely patriarchal. And you can see that, for example, if you read Sheila Rowbottom's work, feminist historians' work on looking at, you know, the way that peasant women were treated, for instance. She writes in one of the passages of her work that a husband would sometimes be given a whip when he got married in order to use on his wife. So here is a deeply patriarchal society. This revolution then occurs, led by this principle that everybody is equal. And gender equality was, to some degree, woven into that. You know, women were involved in that revolution. They were part of it. The issue was, I mean, there are a number of issues. It's such a complicated story, of course. This turned out to, you know, be an incredibly brutal and authoritarian regime, the Soviet Union. But in its early days, it really did try to live up to that promise of gender equality. The Soviet Union became the first country in the world to legalize abortion. That was in 1920. It introduced very quickly education, broadening out education to everybody, including women, introducing laws that meant that a pregnant woman couldn't be fired, for instance. It made it very easy for people to get divorced if they wanted to, which women took up. They're quite happy, you know, to have that kind of freedom. And in certain Eastern and Central European socialist states, people were given childcare, very free childcare, as much as they wanted. There were public laundries, public canteens at work, which they could get their food from. So, you know, to some degree, this was, in the 20th century, perhaps the biggest attempt in thousands of years to really smash the patriarchy. The reason it didn't work, of course, and there are many reasons it didn't work, is because the state couldn't deliver on so many different counts. It was brutal and authoritarian. It didn't offer people the other freedoms that they needed. And so it collapsed. But I think there is value in looking at that history and what the role that women played in that revolution and what they did manage to achieve, and ask ourselves, you know, is there anything we can take away from that history?
Yes, but the end result was that women had the double burden, didn't they, because of their biological differences, that they were expected to look after the children, cook the meal at night, as well as engage in paid work. I mean, the Soviet Union, didn't it, saw paid work as a way to women's freedom, but from what I've read, they always had this double burden, and all these decisions that were made were in the Communist Party were mainly made by men. There were very few key women figures.
Yeah, absolutely. And I go into depth about that, because this is certainly what feminist scholars of that era have written very widely about, is the ways in which the regime did let down women. It didn't promote them within the party. There were very few women in the leadership, even up until the end, even into the 1980s, there were very few women at the top of the Communist Party. And this double burden, I mean, the double burden, I wouldn't say is a product of biology. It's not as though women were biologically suited to housework or cooking or the work at home. That could have been done by anyone. The problem was that at no point did the authorities require men to do that work at home. They allowed whatever was happening in the domestic sphere to just continue while trying to create gender equality outside the domestic sphere. And that was the big failure, I guess. And you know, in the rest of the world, and this is where another tension came in, was that people could see that in the US, they were developing domestic time-saving appliances that were making life easier for people, like washing machines and dishwashers and other things. And in the Soviet Union, because of the economic situation, people didn't have access to those. So the work was still hard, the work that was meant to be done at home. Now, of course, those changes, those domestic changes, have happened all over the world in different ways since then because of the choices that we make. So, for example, in my family, my parents cut everything down the middle. It's not as though domestic work is treated as my mum's job. It never was from when I was little. Childcare was something they both shared. And that's true also in my family. But that domestic change, I think, while the state can be involved in that and provide an example, also has to come from people themselves, everyday people.
Perhaps while we're on that theme of the Russian Revolution, which began in 1917, we may jump up to 1959, this debate between President Nixon of the USA and Khrushchev of the Soviet Union, the so-called kitchen debate, which has always intrigued me. Do you want to say a little bit about that?
I mean, I moved to the US about a year and a half ago, and this is a country that is, I mean, I think people outside underestimate just how religious it is and how much it is still committed, how heavily it is still committed to this idea that a domesticated woman is some kind of ideal. People still look up to that 1950s ideal. And in that era, when the Soviet Union was pushing for gender equality, more and more women were going into higher education and into work. In the US, exactly the opposite was happening. So while before the Second World War, many more women had been in higher education, after the war, numbers dropped quite dramatically. And women, once they got married, were encouraged to give up work. It was expected that they would give up work. This ideology of the domesticated woman really took hold. And what was interesting was that this created a kind of oppositional binary between the East and the West, between the Soviet Union and the US, in which the Soviet Union, for example, in this kitchen debate between Nixon and Khrushchev, the Soviet Union, Nixon said to Khrushchev, look at all these amazing appliances that our women have that make their life easier at home. And Khrushchev said, well, we don't treat our women like domestic slaves that have to stay at home. And they were both right in their own way, and they were both wrong in their own way. You know, both of these ways of characterizing women had their problems. But what it really did underscore was that, I mean, I think one of the tragedies of all of that was that because the US pitted itself ideologically so against the Soviet Union and against socialism, because women's rights was associated with socialism, it also meant that gains around women's rights were slower in the US as a result. It took a long time for Roe v. Wade. It took a long time for laws to be passed to make it easier for women to work and to get the same pay as men. And I think part of that is because even now, there is still this fear that any kind of fight for equality is associated in some way with communism or socialism.
Yes, interesting. I don't think that's quite the same in Britain. It's probably associated more with the Labour Party, the left, but not quite so pronounced as in the USA. And just before we leave that topic, I think what's quite interesting is your take as well on the former Soviet states, how, you know, Hungary and Poland, they're very right-wing presidents, and how they've developed really this religious conservatism, you call it, as a way to distance themselves from their former lives under the Soviet Union.
I mean, this is something we've definitely seen in the former socialist states, is that after 1990, there was a push to return to tradition. And what does tradition really mean in a country that was patriarchal in the 19th century? Inevitably, that means that you go back to these patriarchal customs. And that's exactly what's happened in kind of the Catholic Church has played a huge part, for example, in Poland's decision to introduce legislation against abortion. And in Hungary as well, what you see is constantly this refrain about the, you know, the traditional family, that there is a certain way that you should live, that women can work, but they should also have as many children as possible. And certainly Orban has introduced measures, financial incentives for families to have as many kids as possible. So part of that, I would say, is a reaction to what went before, that there was this rush to distance themselves from Soviet policies and Soviet ideology, and a rush into a kind of nostalgic tradition of the past. And that inevitably, I think, has had terrible consequences for women.
You speak in your book, Angela, about the Iranian Revolution of 1979. I wonder if you could expand a little on that for us, please.
Well, it was interesting. I actually wrote about this and researched it long before the protests happened last year. So it's been quite interesting for me to see that period of history in the context of what is happening now. Because in 1979, we forget that women were also involved in that revolution. Socialists were part of that revolution. It was a popular revolution. Everybody, you know, it was very widespread. The reason that Khomeini took power was because there were very few other systems or alternatives, political alternatives. And that was partly because the Shah had been so successful in quashing alternatives. He had done a lot to suppress other political movements, but also because the religious conservatives remained powerful even while the Shah was there. So even though Khomeini was in exile, the religious conservatives still had a lot of sway over the population. What happened in 1979 was the Shah had become increasingly associated with the West. He had, you know, he was seen as this kind of almost Western stooge who was selling his country to foreign interests. And that was having an impact then on social customs, on, you know, for example, he banned the veil. He said that women couldn't wear the veil. So during the revolution, women actually started taking up the veil as a symbol of opposition to the Shah, opposition to the authoritarian regime, and solidarity with poorer and rural women who tended to veil at that period of time. So what's interesting is if you look at that history then, the veil was a symbol of freedom from oppression, of liberation, paradoxically. What is happening now during the protests is that it has become exactly the opposite, because the Islamic Republic have instituted this veil as mandatory. They have curbed women's freedoms in terms of what they can wear, what they can do, how they can travel. The laws are still deeply in favor of men, for example, in marriage. So taking off the veil now has become that symbol of liberation.
Angela, you mention in your book the importance of colonialism and how ideas from the West were often taken over to people who were colonized. Do you want to say a little bit about that?
We often imagine that gender equality is kind of a new invention of the West and that when the rest of the world is kind of being enlightened. And certainly I think that's how a lot of, you know, fans of the Enlightenment, for instance, like to phrase it. What we forget is that there are many parts of the world that have very strong matrilineal traditions in which women have historically had a lot of authority. And what European colonialism did in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, and missionaries, religious missionaries, was to export a very rigid idea about what women were, the roles of men and women, this idea that women were the inferiors of men in some way, which is something I've explored in my other books, and institute that in the places that they were governing. You see that in India, you see it in North America in devastating ways, in Australia, for instance. So in North America, because this is where I happen to live now, Native American children were sent to boarding schools, and those boarding schools would train boys and girls differently, teach women to be housewives, domestic housewives, and teach boys that, you know, their place was in agriculture or somewhere else in the public space, when that is not how many indigenous communities would live. For example, the Haudenosaunee, which are a very important Native American community in large parts of America, including in New York, women were heavily involved in agriculture. They had a lot of authority. They were clan mothers way before there were founding fathers. I write about in my book. And these clan mothers were incredibly important to their communities. And what settler colonialism did was bit by bit try and chip away at all of that and legally keep handing authority to men. So we have to remember that this history is as much a vehicle of patriarchy as what happened thousands of years ago. This is within living memory. And one of the reasons I start the book off with the story about North America and the Haudenosaunee is because this is something that people can relate to even now because they live through it. We can see the imposition of patriarchy in our own lifetimes because people are still living through it. And if we can do that, then that's also useful for historians because it helps us understand that even in the past, things would have been more complicated than we imagine.
So how are we going to dismantle patriarchy? That's the question feminists ask, and I often think about it, yes.
Well, I think what I was trying to do with this book is, you know, when we imagine patriarchy, we treat it as this monolithic thing, almost like an abstract force that is so big and so pervasive that there's no way that we will ever combat it altogether. And what I wanted to do was break it down and just say, well, actually, look, in practice, how does it actually manifest? In what small, subtle ways does it actually weave its way through our, not just our legal institutions and governmental ones, but also through our cultures and religions and the little everyday acts of support or solidarity that we show, how open we leave people to alienation or loneliness and how that can make them vulnerable in marriage or otherwise. So I hope that if we can see those little things in our everyday lives, then we can start to combat it. So for example, I remember when I was writing my book and I was traveling in Berlin, I met a friend there who is a very big champion for women in science, who has always fought for gender equality in science. She mentioned to me that at home, her dad would come home and sit on the sofa and her mum would wait on him hand and foot. And this was just the pattern in their household. And I asked her, why do you not challenge that? This is something that's, gender equality is something that's so important to you out in public. Would you ever question what's happening in your own home? And I think that's where it becomes difficult. That's where the real challenge lies, is how in our everyday lives are we actually combating this at that level?
In the late 80s, actually, early 90s, I was giving a paper at a conference on the education of working class women in 19th century England. It's what I'd researched quite a bit on. And I did it from a feminist perspective, and I was using the word patriarchy. It was a sort of silence in the room a bit. And then at the end of the session, the male professor of the history of education said to me, June, if I had known you were going to talk about patriarchy, I would not have let you give the paper. Actually said to me. And I mean, the irony of the situation, that the very thing I was talking about, he said he wouldn't have allowed me to talk about. I agree, you know, it's here, there and everywhere, but that was in an academic conference. As you know, my field is sort of women's history, and patriarchy was very much a concept used by feminist historians in the 70s and 80s. But Judith Bennett, in this book of hers in 2006 called History Matters, she said it's barely whispered now by feminist historians in the 21st century. And I've been thinking about that. Why do you think that is so now, that feminist historians don't talk about patriarchy, which is one reason why I so wanted to read your book?
I think it has fallen out of favor, there's no doubt. So on the one hand, it's very popular in public discourse. So young women will use this phrase all the time. We talk about smashing the patriarchy all the time. But you're right, in the literature, I think part of the reason for it is that in the 80s and in the 90s, it became very clear that it was so abstract, it almost lost meaning, that it almost didn't mean anything anymore, and nobody could really pin it down. And in that sense, it became less useful as a concept, because what was it really? And I think this was one of the things I had to grapple with when I was writing this book, is what is patriarchy really? What can we say that it actually is? And try to make it less abstract. And I think when we make it less abstract, and this is one of the reasons why I say there is no one patriarchy, there are many patriarchies always changing and always shifting, and it's much more useful to envisage it that way, then you can grab hold of it. Then it suddenly becomes a useful thing. And maybe we won't use it. Maybe we'll think of a different word for this. But at least that way you can get a sense of it, at least. Because at the moment, sometimes the way we use it, it almost feels that it has no sense at all.
So it's a debate that continues, I think.
It is, yeah. As always in feminist history, these debates continue.
That was Angela Saini in conversation with June Purvis. Angela's book, The Patriarchs, How Men Came to Rule, is published by Fourth Estate. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Jack Bateman.